Save mental energy managing your WordPress site with easy-to-use DIY features from WP Engine's Managed WordPress Hosting. Visit wpengine.com/loveyourwork for up to 4 months free. This is Love Your Work. On this show, we introduce you to the people and give you the tools to carve out success by your own definition. I'm David Cadavy, and I'm a best-selling author and entrepreneur. Every Thursday, I love bringing you a new episode in which I dissect the unique path of a guest, what clues help them find their calling, how do they cut out the noise to focus, and where have they made compromises. Or I bring you lessons I've learned for myself. If this is your first time listening, be sure to check out some of our most popular episodes, Jason Fried on episode 1, neuroscientist John Cunios on episode 8, and Laura Roeder on episode 9. And if you like what you hear, please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and write a review. Just go to cadavy.net/review. I work really hard bringing this show to you, so when you subscribe and review, it will help me keep doing that for you. Thanks. Our guest today is Ryan Holiday. Ryan is the author of a new book, Ego is the Enemy. How can your ego hold you back in aspirations, your successes, and in your failures? Ryan covers it all in his book. You can buy it at cadavy.net/ego. As Ryan talks about in the discussion, he sort of wrote the book for himself. Ryan had an unusual amount of success very early in life. He dropped out of college at 19 to apprentice under author Robert Greene. He worked for Beverly Hills Talent Agency, advising multi-platinum musicians, and he was the head of marketing at American Apparel by the time he was about 21. In addition to writing books, Ryan helps other authors market their books. He's worked with authors like Tucker Max, who we spoke with on episode 29, and Tim Ferriss and James Altucher. In this discussion, we talk about how to recognize how ego holds you back in all aspects of life and work, and what to do about it. There are lots of helpful thoughts about how to balance your passion projects with your day job, and we also talk about so-called pageview economics, something Ryan has a lot of insight into. If you want to know how media works, you should check out his first book, Trust Me, I'm Lying, Confessions of a Media Manipulator. You can find that at cadavy.net/trustme. Here's the interview. Want to maximize your email marketing? You should try ActiveCampaign. I switched last year from MailChimp and I love it. With email marketing, marketing automation, and a sales CRM, it's a powerful, intuitive, and complete platform. Claim your 14-day free trial of ActiveCampaign at activecampaign.com/loveyourwork. I'm here with Ryan Holiday, author of The Ego is the Enemy. Ryan, what was it that compelled you to write The Ego is the Enemy?
A lot of things, really.
Well, I guess it's Ego is the Enemy, first of all. Sorry.
Yeah, no. A lot of things compelled me to write the book. A big one was obviously the collapse of American Apparel in 2014, which I had spent a lot of time and energy in, and I believed a great deal in the company. When you watch, you know, this firm that you watch become a billion-dollar company suddenly, you know, be not far from bankruptcy, and a mentor of yours get fired by the board of the directors, all in, you know, a sudden sort of momentous event, it makes you wonder, you know, what happened? Is this a path that I'm on? Could something like this happen to me? And the other bigger motivation, because I'd been thinking about writing this book before all that happened, was just a sense of, you know, in my own journey as someone who became successful relatively early on in life, the way that success can sort of warp with your mind, the temptation to start to think that you're special or unique, or that this is fate, that this is how it's supposed to be. I found sort of warps your perspective. It sucks at your happiness, and it prevents you from doing the things that you're good at. So it's a number of factors, but really I was just fascinated with this idea of does everyone who's successful have to be a total asshole and have to be totally unaware, you know, unself-aware? And maybe I wanted to prove that that's not true.
So it sounds in a way like you wrote the book for yourself, or your younger self.
Definitely. I mean, I think every writer is writing for themselves as at least a major part of the audience. I try to write for both a younger version of myself and then where I think where I'm going to be in the near future, right? So I'm writing for myself sort of right now, and I'm writing what I wish I knew a year ago or 5 years ago. So when I use the word you in the book, I'm really referring to something I've personally done. I'm not saying like you suck. I'm saying, hey, we suck when we do this, you know?
It's like you're writing the Marcus Aurelius Meditations, where he's writing you, and he's writing to himself.
Look, I wouldn't want to compare myself to him, because I mean, he's one of the most intelligent philosophers to ever live. But you know, he really was only writing for himself. There's a purity there in that book that I think is so special. When you write a book that was never intended for publication, obviously it's a little bit different than someone like me who's trying to publish my work. I have to think about, you know, I'm obviously influenced by the audience to a certain degree, but I've definitely internalized that style. And I think if the author isn't talking to themselves, if the author doesn't at least consider themselves as part of the audience, then really you're just lecturing, and that's not particularly pleasurable to read.
Right. And so what were some of the things that you learned about ego in your lifetime, in this process leading up to this book?
A lot. I mean, one of the things, I think we tend to, There's a certain amount of survivorship bias inherent in our understanding of ego, right? We meet lots of really successful people with huge egos because we don't hear about all the people whose egos destroyed them and were sort of never heard from again. So that's a big part of it. And then the other part of it is someone I talk a lot about in the book is George Marshall, who's sort of a hero of mine. He's the creator of the Marshall Plan, the chief of staff during the Second World War, just a brilliant but very humble man. You know, after World War II, he passed on a $1 million offer to write his memoirs. So the reason that we hear about General MacArthur or other generals more than Marshall is not because one is more accomplished than the other. It's that in some ways, the humility of one makes them less prominent than the other. So you really have to dig for it. But when you do dig for it, you find that history is sort of full of these fascinating, accomplished, you know, brilliant individuals who just didn't crave the spotlight and didn't obsess about their own legacy the way that, you know, the people that we do hear about seem to. And I think what's interesting is someone like George Marshall ultimately probably accomplished more as a statesman and as a general than any other person of his generation. And I think he was able to do that precisely because he was so selfless and he didn't create enemies the way that a Patton might have or a MacArthur might have.
And so what are the different ways that ego holds a person back?
I mean, I would say it holds us back in every single way and offers
actually,
us
sorry, let's,
nothing.
Let's define ego too, because I think that there's sure. different understandings of ego.
Yeah, I mean, look, we start with the sort of the Freudian definition, which I don't think is super helpful to people. The psychiatric definition is sort of an unhealthy obsession with the self. I use ego in more the colloquial sense. So it's arrogance and superiority and self-obsession and selfishness and delusions of grandeur. So I'm using it. It's sort of like that definition of pornography. You know it when you see it. Ego is when somebody's being an asshole, basically, right? That's what I'm referring to. I'm not saying I'm using it as an umbrella to address a lot of destructive traits that are common in the creative profession, in politics, in business, and stuff. Ego is when confidence turns to arrogance, essentially.
Right. And in the book, it talks about how ego holds people back in aspirations and in success. And there was one other one.
Failure.
And in failure as well. So can we go quickly through those?
Yeah. I mean, the idea is that any one of us is at either of those three phases at some point in our lives, right? Or at any point in our lives. So we're either aspiring to do something, we're either, you know, dealing with success in one way or another, or we're going through some sort of difficulty or adversity. And at any one of those junctures, ego, I see as an unhelpful ingredient to add into the equation, or a destructive one, really. So when you're just starting out and you're trying to, you know, you're trying to become a writer, you're trying to become a musician, or you're trying to start a company, ego is a toxic variable that disconnects you from the reality of what you're trying to do, that makes it impossible for you to receive feedback, that alienates you from other people, that distracts you from the work that you have to do. When you're successful, ego makes you complacent. It creates enemies, like literal enemies for you, competitors. It makes you delusional. It makes you paranoid. It makes you micromanage. It does all the sort of things that make maintaining that success more difficult. And then when you experience difficulty or failure, the problem is ego is then that voice that says, you know, hey, they're screwing you over. You know, this isn't your fault.
Somebody else's fault. Yeah.
Yeah. Or it says, this is totally your fault because you're a loser and you never should have been successful in the first place, right? It's some of that imposter syndrome. Ego is preventing you from turning this negative experience into a constructive and a positive one. So the idea is wherever you happen to be, whatever you happen to be doing, you're not going to get much from leaning into ego.
Right. And I mean, I can think about, as far as aspirations go, there's this idea of the entrepreneur and entrepreneurship, where I feel like a lot of people aspire to certain types of success, and it becomes a part of their identity, this aspiration. And then in some ways that holds them back from actually moving forward and trying things and testing themselves.
Yeah. Or they say, okay, I want to be, you know, I want to be an entrepreneur. So I want to be Elon Musk, let's say. And instead of sort of homing in on the work that someone like Elon Musk does, they say, how can I pretend that I am Elon Musk? And so they act like that person. They act as if they've already achieved the thing that they want to achieve. And so they're sort of posturing. That's why we call them entrepreneurs, right? They're acting like they're posers, really, right? They're acting like they've done these things. They're reverse engineering what they think the correct pose or approach is, instead of saying, hey, you know, what's the work that I need to be doing? What are the relationships that I need to be doing? What weaknesses do I have that, you know, this person I aspire to be like, you know, solved in themselves, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. And as a, you know, I'll put out there that I'm a recovering entrepreneur myself, but, you know, one thing that I realized the other day was that, you know, it's almost like as if somebody picked up a basketball and then they were like, hey, I'm going to play like Michael Jordan now. I feel like entrepreneurship has this thing where there are all these skills that are required to be successful at it, but it has something about it where it's hard to see that. Maybe it's because people don't watch it on step by step on television. Sure. Or something like that. And that makes it this nice cozy blanket that you can sit inside, that you have this identity that you're this entrepreneur, and you can aspire to being like Steve Jobs or Elon Musk or something without realizing how much work actually goes into it.
Yeah, it's probably a little bit like the iceberg theory, right? We're just seeing the top 10%, and we're ignoring all the things that are under the surface. And, you know, you're seeing, you know, you and I are, we saw Steve Jobs at his apex. We did not see Steve Jobs when he was our age. You know, we did not see Steve Jobs when he was starting his company. You know, we didn't even see Steve Jobs when he was at his worst, when he was fired from Apple, like deservedly so, right? For being an asshole. we see what he's able to get away with as the CEO of the world's most valuable company.
Yeah, I mean, Apple started in like 1976, and you know, how long was it before like they really hit their stride? Like 2006, 30 years later.
Totally, and the amount of work and relationships and meetings he had to sit through, and things that he didn't show up and park in a handicap spot on the first day. You know, that's not how it worked. Not that he should have done that, but I think here's what I think people miss. They see the egos of successful people and they confuse correlation and causation, right? They think that the ego is somehow what's allowed them to be successful, instead of the fact that it's like, hey, Steve Jobs is so supremely talented and so presciently called a handful of technological shifts in the American culture that he was able to get away with being a colossal asshole and doing these things, right? And people tolerated it. But even as they tolerated, they shook their heads and they were like, this is so unnecessary. You don't need to be doing this. Why are you screaming at people? You know, this is only making this harder for you, right? We see that with a Kanye West. We go, oh, Kanye West, like, you must need to be, you know, insane to be a great rapper. And it's like, no, actually, how much better would Kanye West be if he didn't spend his time, you know, acting like a weirdo?
Right. And actually, it's sort of like the success makes it easier to have this extra ego in the,
yeah.
And then it's a halo effect. And then you hold you back in subsequent success.
Yeah, it's a bit of a halo effect, and I think that's one of the things that we miss. We go, this person is successful compared to me, therefore their ego must not be a problem. What we don't say, because you know you're not in the boardroom when Kanye West is negotiating something or working on something, we don't see, and I happen to have seen it with a number of successful people that I've worked with. You don't see how they want to accomplish certain things, but they're often the main impediment for achieving that thing, right? They're the reason, they're the reason that they don't have all the success that they want. Their ego is what's preventing them from achieving their own relative goals. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true for all of us. Like, even, it's not that anyone is without ego. It's that wherever there is ego, there are unnecessary problems and unnecessary difficulties and struggle and pain.
Yeah, as a one-time author, this is something that I think about a lot, because I think about, you know, the idea of a sophomore slump that you see in music or something like that. Somebody has a great hit up front, and then I think ego probably in the fog of success fools them into thinking that they can go ahead and repeat that.
You know, in both ways. I mean, look, I saw this. So my last book was much more successful than I'd sort of anticipated it would be. But I was very fortunate in that I'd sold this book before that book came out. Okay. So I was already busy working on. So in some ways, I sort of, you know, I left a lot of money on the table. Like if I'd waited, I would have been able to sell this for more money. But I didn't, obviously, in hindsight, I only know this, but I was so busy working on this book that I didn't really get to sit there and go like, oh, this is so amazing. You know, I'm so special. I can't believe I'm selling all, you know, so that was part of it. And then, you know, so you experience that sort of fear of this, that slump manifests itself in two ways. One, you can be so convinced that, you know, your first album was amazing because you're amazing and everything you do is amazing. And then what you make, you know, doesn't hold up. Or conversely, you make something, it's successful, and then you're so intimidated by your own success. You're sort of egotistically self-absorbed, but in a negative way. You're, I could never do this again. It was luck. You know, it's blah, blah, blah. When really you should be zeroing in. Okay, what actually made that? Why was this a success? Well, it's because I worked really hard, because I poured a lot of creative energy into this project. I put in the time, I built the relationships, you know, I put in the work, and circumstances aligned in such a way that all of that was able to, you know, coalesce around the same project. So luck, essentially. That is the attitude that you want to take from a successful project. But ego makes difficult, you know, with two different, you know, opposite interpretations, neither of which is helpful.
Yeah, this is something I think about a lot as I'm trying to figure out how to like write a second book. But I have to look back and realize, like, the first book, I sort of wrote some blog posts. They got really popular. I got a book deal. You've seen, you know, my book proposal for at least an old version of the one that I'm like working on now. And you know, now I've like gone in public and riffed on it and shown it to agents and stuff, and like been really humbled at, wow, this is some really lukewarm reception. And so I'm having to like regroup and try to figure out how to capture that interest and that fire again. And I'm glad that I did before instead, you know, I could have decided like, oh, I'm just going to self-publish this idea that isn't resonating with people or something like that.
Sure. I mean, look, the same thing happened for me with this book. The first proposal was rejected. The second proposal was rejected. The third proposal was kind of rejected and then begrudgingly accepted. And then the book itself became something even radically more different than what either of us had anticipated. And so you have to have that flexibility to be able to adjust. Like, I mean, if you had been convinced that the proposal that you made was pure greatness, or if I was convinced that, you know, what I made was just misunderstood and, you know, these idiots didn't, you know, didn't realize what, you know, they didn't realize who they were dealing with, I would have forced something that ultimately I was wrong about, right? Like I would have, you know, there's a quote from Epictetus that I have in the book. One cannot learn that which they think they already know. One can't get feedback on something that they profoundly believe is perfect, or one cannot learn if they believe that they are better than everyone else. And so I think that's the tough situation that we put ourselves in with ego in a creative profession that is so dependent on a fluid connection to feedback and reactions.
Yeah, and there's how ego affects a person in failure or adversity. Is how do you view that? Is it a bunch of people who are idiots who don't get what you're saying, or is it feedback that you can use?
Right, because so often we fail, and then when we blame other people, now we don't think that we failed. We think that they failed us, so we double down on whatever we did, you know, in the first place. And so that's how, you know, we're sort of leveling up our failure.
It's another nice, comfortable, warm blanket that we can wrap ourselves in.
Sure, yeah. I mean, look, the reason ego exists is comfort, really. Like, it's certainly not adaptive. So what it's there for is to put at arm's length those feelings we would rather not have to feel.
We're going to take a quick break. Being productive in your business is all about mind management, not time management, which is why I use WP Engine's managed WordPress hosting to host all of my WordPress sites. They have really easy to use DIY tools, so managing my sites is as simple as can be, and I can focus my mental energy on the things I do best, like bringing you this show. I don't have to worry about installing WordPress, I don't have to worry about keeping it up to date, and I don't have to worry about backups or security. WP Engine takes care of all of it for me. With WP Engine's tools, you can quickly launch new sites, protect existing sites, and test plugin updates. They back up everything daily, and you can make changes on a staging version of your WordPress site before pushing your changes live. They also have a built-in CDN. What does that mean? That means your WordPress site is super fast. Visit wpengine.com/loveyourwork for up to 4 months free with WP Engine. I want to go through some of the ways that you personally have fought ego or encountered it. You mentioned American Apparel, and I remember hearing in your Tim Ferriss podcast some kind of like anti-materialism stoic thoughts.
Yeah,
I thought that was really interesting because, you know, if you are materialistic, and I think you might have mentioned this in the book, if you're materialistic, it can put you in financial positions where, okay, now financially I have to do things that are not close to my core in order to sustain this sort of thing.
Yeah, totally. If you're, I mean, even with my books, right? Like, because I have a successful business, I'm able to play the long game with my books. Whereas if I was forced to eat off the revenue from my books, I might have to compromise myself artistically or message wise to be able to sell more in the short term. But I think what happens is people get themselves in a position where they think their material possessions say something about them as a person. So having a nice car is central to your identity. Having an impressive house that, you know, takes people's breath away is central to your identity. Having your kids in private school is essential to your identity. Any number of these things. And then it prevents you from seeing transactions or, life choices in an objective way, because having that money is necessary to continue this sort of illusion that you've created for yourself. So, you know, you don't want to walk away from your Wall Street job to do some other thing that you might actually make you happier, because, you know, you don't know who you would be if you're not driving a BMW. You know, or because you believe that an apartment has to be, you know, X number of square feet or larger, or it has to be an X neighborhood or better, you know, you are now unable to be as flexible or as fluid in your decisions in the pursuit of goals or objectives, because you have to maintain a certain lifestyle or a certain identity. And so it makes difficult things even more difficult.
Yeah. And you live out in the country, basically, outside of Austin, correct?
Yeah. I live about 30 minutes outside of Austin. And Austin itself, I know you spent some time, is not, you know, the epicenter of the United States. I sort of see it as a nice mix of a big city and a small city. But because, you know, the people who I see every day are not the kind of people that I need to work particularly hard to impress, because they don't really care about what I'm doing or what's going on, that allows me to focus on my own sort of internal scorecard, my own internal metrics of what I think is impressive and what I think is important. Like, I live on a dirt road. I don't need to, if I drove a fancy car, I would not only not be impressing anyone, I would be being like quite stupid. You know, and so it just sort of takes a lot of those things off the table.
Yeah, and this reminds me of kind of the antithesis of this being the place where you and I met was, yeah, it was in New York.
Totally. I mean, like, you know, we met in a penthouse apartment that probably is three or four times my mortgage. And it wasn't like anywhere close to the nicest apartment that I've ever been in New York. You know what I mean? There's one of the things that I found in New York too, was you would go around, you'd go to parties. Well, first off, there was a constant pressure to be places, right? Because there's so much going on. You felt like there's a lot of FOMO. Like if you say no to this, to sit in your apartment, you feel like you're making a poor decision. Whereas I sat in my living room in Austin last night, and I didn't feel like I was missing out on a party in New York City because it would be silly for me to fly there and go to it, right? But I also think it's, you know, when there's a lot of jaded, you know, materialistic people around you, and they're like, what do you do for a living? And you describe it, and then they make you feel, you know, they're judging you. That now you, it's just, it's like you're on a track and a lot of people are zipping around. You feel like you subconsciously have to pick up your pace, even if you were quite happy with the pace that you were at.
Yeah. And we had a little bit of a conversation about mini lives then, I think, spending a month or two in various places. That strikes me as like a very relevant to the idea of ego, or recognizing one's ego, because living in a place for a period of time helps you get a better sense of who you are as a person. Is that something that you've found?
Yeah, well, look, I was talking to someone yesterday and he was trying to sell me on going to TED, and I was like, look, I just don't have that much interest in going. But he was like, here's why you go. It's very expensive, but you will go there and you're the least successful person there. So it's very humbling. Mm-hmm. And he was like, All the things that you've done, you know, pale in comparison to all the things that these other people have done. And that sort of puts you in your place a little bit. And I know that somewhat contradicts what we're just talking about, but I would wonder if one of the benefits of the mini life is that you go somewhere where you kind of don't know anyone. You're kind of starting from scratch. You know, you're just not walking around like you're the king of the neighborhood. You're walking around in a more open, you know, receptive mindset where you're trying. It's inherently a curious, intake focused mindset rather than, you know, the way one might walk around the neighborhood in which they've spent their entire lives that they feel like they own and is a part of them.
Yeah. And so the various places that you lived for a month or two at a time were like New York, New Orleans.
I've never done a month, but I spent a year in New York. I spent 2 years in New Orleans. I spent 5 years in LA. And then I travel a lot. I spend longer periods of time. You know, I'll spend 2 weeks in Miami, or I'll spend 3 weeks, you know, in Europe on a speaking gig / writing, you know, session or whatever. So I spend a lot of time in different places, but I have felt every time I've gone somewhere and had to kind of reinvent my life, even moving to the city in Austin and then moving to the country, you're forced to relate to new people and remake, you know, your routine in a way that I think is good because it breaks down some of the bad habits that you might have accumulated elsewhere.
Right. I want to circle back to your first book because I've had a few conversations on my podcast about kind of page view economics and the erosion of focus in culture and how page view economics drives that. So maybe you could give us an introduction to page view economics, first of all.
Well, I mean, I think people are more familiar with it than maybe they realize. It's like, why do you think, you know, why... A few years ago, why was every article broken up into five pages, like, or into a slideshow? It's to get you to click more. Why does Facebook autoplay its videos, whereas YouTube doesn't? It's to get you to watch more videos. Like, in a world where the media is advertising supported versus subscriber supported, and it's really easy to do design tweaks. All of these products are designed to be as addictive as humanly possible, to generate as many clicks as possible. And so that's why every headline is inflammatory, every article is polarized, you know, every image or thumbnail that you see is provocative. The idea is, how can we get you to click so we can sell that click to another person in essentially a real-time auction? That's how the media works today. And the result, I think, has been a complete, collapse of any political or social or cultural order, and it's very difficult to make sense of.
Right, and I thought a great observation that you had in there was, oh, if you are a journalist and you invest in a company, it's considered unethical for you to write about that company, right?
It's a conflict of interest.
Conflict of interest. However, a lot of these media companies, or maybe all of them, I've even heard of friends who are journalists at what I would consider to be reputable publications, their performance is evaluated on the number of page views that they are able to generate.
Yeah, so that makes, in my opinion, every article that they write a source of conflict of interest.
Very
totally.
Clear, yes.
Totally. And it's not as if they're when an author is selling a book, you understand they want you to buy it. But that's a financial exchange that you're entering in willfully. What's different is when you read it, when you see a headline and you think, oh, is that true? And then you don't realize that the person who wrote it, who positioned it, was incentivized to make you click it. There is zero consequences for you being disappointed once you've clicked. You can't unclick, you can't unlike, you know, it's... When their role is to steal as much attention from you as they possibly can.
Right. Perfect example of this. I just was listening yesterday to a Louis C.K. podcast interview, and he just released this series, Horace and Pete. He self-funded it, and he on Howard Stern said, oh, you know, I still haven't made my money back yet. And so everybody, which is ridiculous, because it would
right.
There's no way he could make it back that fast. He had to take debt to, sure. to make the show. And of course, all the journalists run with it. Louis C.K. is broke. Horace and Pete was a failure, et cetera, et cetera. And the actual story is just, you know, it's done pretty well, and he hasn't made his money back yet.
Yeah, and what I think is so fascinating about it is all those people, or many of them, cover entertainment for a living, and they know that most entertainment projects do not make money immediately, and that the entire concept of the entertainment business is that you lose money for the first few years, and you make up the money over the long term, right? Like once it's
streaming on Netflix, I mean,
right? A single Netflix deal will make him whole on that project, from what I'd heard about it. And so you see, it's not just that they're sensationalizing; it's people who know the actual truth, deliberately presenting things in a misleading or inaccurate way because that's in their interest. And so people are reading things that are genuinely presented as true, but are knowingly false because that's what suits the interests of the people writing it.
And look at the way that ego fuels that. You know, these people are surrounded by other people living the same sort of lifestyle, and you know, maybe they live in the
They're all. Oh, did you see Business Insider got 1 million page views writing about Louis C.K. being broke? Let's write the same. They're all competing with each other to get more traffic than each other. It's all how many followers do we have? How many views did this article go? It's this competition, and no one is thinking the longer game of, hey, does anyone trust us anymore? You know, do we have any actual readers who give a shit what we're talking about?
Right, and you know, this is maybe a little bit abstract, but on the outside of that is just this sort of existential crisis that they might be having, like, oh, this is important to my career, or gosh, I've got to pay my $3,000 a month studio apartment rent in New York somehow, and all these things that create the fuel for them to continue that.
Totally. Jake Dobkin, who runs Gothamness, which is one of my favorite New York sites, he's talked about for a long time just the sheer ego and ridiculousness of the New York Times pretending that they need to do these things to compete with page view journalism, when really they could sell their headquarters in Times Square for billions of dollars, move the paper to some less sexy place, whether it's New Jersey or Philadelphia or upstate New York, produced the exact same, you know, quality of work that they were famous for, funded by, you know, their ability to say, hey, you know, our address does not define who we are as an institution. And so, you know, even in Austin, which I'm sure you saw, that the Austin Chronicle, the Austin Statesman is on this beautiful riverfront property right next to downtown, which is worth probably tens of millions of dollars. Meanwhile, the newspaper, you know, produces crap to appeal to sort of page you hungry readers in social media, but they could move to the suburbs and avoid all of that. But ego is what sticks you there.
I mean, is there any way out? It seems like this has gotten so out of hand that, you know, the economic equation just feels so broken. You know, what's the solution? Do you have any theories on that?
I mean, I wish I was smart enough to come up with a solution. I don't know what it is. I think what first has to happen is that audiences have to realize just how manipulative. You can't trust the people who are doing the manipulation are not suddenly going to wake up and be like, hey, we got to stop manipulating people. I think audiences have to be the sort of impetus for that change. But look, there's plenty of success stories. I think I wrote an article recently about the Wirecutter, you know, which is the Wirecutter did $115 million in e-commerce transactions last year with like a staff of like 10 people, because instead of supporting their site through advertising, they supported it through actually recommending products that people like and buy. through affiliate links. And so, you know, there are people who are experimenting with different economic media models, but sadly, they're more the exception than the rule.
I mean, I know this is something that I personally am starting to, okay, if there's a podcast that I listen to, I try to donate to it, or yeah. I subscribe to the New Yorker. Like, I try to, it's like going to Whole Foods and buying, you know, sure. some healthy food instead of some junk food.
Not all calories like are, yeah. Not all calories are created equal, and not all calories are equally ethical, right? And I think we're starting to realize that about information as well.
Yeah, I feel like people are at least starting to wise up a bit. There's been some backlash, I think.
I hopefully.
And, which actually makes me think about your love for books. Like, when I first met you, I remember you looked at me just really sincerely and you said, "I love books so much." And I can see, because you have a huge
that's
wall
not all of my
books behind you. I mean, yeah, I know. I've seen pictures of it before. And yeah. That's something that I've thought about a lot myself, you know. It's just like, wait, when you said that, I was like, oh, wait, I think I love books too. But I haven't, like, really been, you know, doing something about that. But, you know, since sure. then, I have done more, like, try to buy books all the time sure. and see it as an investment and such.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think books are immune in some ways to the economics that we're just talking about, because they are a transaction between consenting parties. And if you read a book and the author lets you down, obviously you don't have recourse. You don't just like get a refund, but you don't buy from that author anymore. You're like, that guy sucks. You know, if someone bought my book and they hated it, they're not going to be tricked into buying my other books the way that they might be with an article. And so I think that's great. And also, look, books are, as a physical product, a book is designed to stand the test of time. We still read Homer, you know, we still read Thucydides, you know, these are books that have lasted for thousands of years. And that's not to say that, you know, what I write is going to last for thousands of years. And I don't, that would be ridiculous to think so. But I'm trying to last more than a morning or more than, you know, a weekend of social media sharing. I'm trying to make something that lasts for a year or 10 years. And so I'm less incentivized to take shortcuts or to bend the truth or the facts, because it doesn't suit me.
Yeah. We are getting really close to the end of our time here. So I want to get to some of the rapid fire questions.
Let's do it.
What's the biggest compromise that you've had to make to get where you are today?
I mean, look, making a book is a never ending series of compromises, from the cover to the title to the content, right? So I feel like traditional publishing has been quite a few compromises for me, but ultimately I don't think I'm giving anything up. I think it's that compromise that's getting me closer to what I need or want to do anyway, that if I, given my own way immediately, I wouldn't have thought of.
Right. And you've used this phrase already. I promise this is actually one of my canned questions. When was the time that you left money on the table?
What
did you get in return?
A lot. I think one of the things, I have an Airbnb rental. I'll give you an example. I have an Airbnb rental, and so it'll get rented out, but oftentimes at an inconvenience to me, right? And so I was thinking recently, like, oh, this person wants to pay me this. And then I realized, like, well, then I have to drive there. Then I don't have access to it. It'll be hugely inconvenient. And I had to do this calculation, which we don't do enough, which is, what is an hour of your time worth? Like, what is your time worth? And are you making more, an equal or a more amount to that time? And if you're not, it's not usually worth it. And I have to think about that a lot. You know, it's like, hey, it would be easier to... It would be cheaper if I drove my car there, but if I take an Uber, I can sit in the back of the car and I can work, or I can do a phone call, or, you know, stuff like that. So I try to leave money on the table when I'm not actually leaving money on the table. It just feels like I'm leaving money on the table.
So you have to make a counterintuitive calculation.
Yes. Yes.
What was the last book that you read that changed the way you saw something?
All the time. I just read this book called Lincoln, An Ethical Biography, which I loved. And you're from Chicago, right?
Well, I mean, that's where I spent the last 8 years or so.
Okay. Well, Lincoln's a fascinating character. And what this book was talking about, how we bend over backwards to deny or pretend that Lincoln wasn't a politician, which is really counterproductive. He's like, look, Lincoln was a career politician. That was his job. He just also happened to be an ethical human being who believed in what he believed in. And so to me, it was like, oh, wait, politics doesn't have to be dirty and disgusting and awful. In fact, pragmatism and purpose can coalesce with each other, and it's exceptions like Lincoln that should, you know, sort of urge all of us to a higher standard.
Yeah. Do you make your bed?
No.
It's not one of your rituals or anything?
It's not. I mean, I've heard great things about making it a ritual, but I usually just wake up and leave.
You know, actually, I'm surprised very few of the guests are bed makers.
It's very easy in theory to tell people to do it, and then I just never do it.
Yeah. Do you have a final message for our listeners who are looking to carve out success by their own definition?
You know, no, I don't have any specific advice. I would say, you know, in my life, one of the things that's been helpful, like mentors have been very helpful to me, sort of building those relationships, attaching myself to people who I wanted to be like, and helping them and learning from them. And then the other thing is that, you know, we sort of lionize passion in our society, that like, you got to pursue your calling or your passion. And we don't realize that oftentimes, you know, having something that you're pretty good at but not super passionate about that might be lucrative can help fund or make those passionate projects more sustainable. So I urge people not to be so closed-minded about like having a day job or a, you know, a profession or whatever.
Right. And where can people find more of you?
RyanHoliday.net or at Ryan Holiday on Twitter.
Great. Well, there's so much more I wish I could talk to you about right now. Like, for example, all those index cards, and I know what those are behind you.
I was going through my books recently. Yeah.
Yeah. But we are out of time, and I have to thank you so much for coming on the show. And Ego is the Enemy is a great book. Congratulations.
This is amazing, man. I really appreciate it. We'll talk soon.
All right. Thanks. Love Your Work is supported in part by Audible. You can try Audible for free at katavi.net/audible. Choose from over 180,000 audiobooks on any subject that you can imagine. Go to katavi.net/audible and claim your free audiobook. There we have it. I hope you enjoyed that episode with Ryan Holiday. You can get his book, Ego is the Enemy, at katavi.net/ego. If you enjoyed that conversation, particularly if you enjoyed the conversation, the part of the conversation about media, about page view economics, you might want to check out my conversation with Nir Eyal on episode 21. You can also subscribe to my book recommendations, mostly the nonfiction on a variety of topics, at katavi.net/reading. Sign up and you'll get my first set of recommendations right away. And you'll be supporting the show if you buy any of those books through the links in the email. This has been Love Your Work, and I'm David Katavi. The theme music for this show is CNU, performed by The Album Leaf, courtesy of Sub Pop Records. Love Your Work is a production of Katavi.